You're listening to Sounds of Science from NJN Public Radio, bringing you leading voices in discovery and innovation. This time, launching ocean observatories, how technology and collaboration are driving a new phase in the exploration of our home planet. I'm Patrick Regan, science and technology correspondent for NJN News. With me in the studio are Scott Glenn and Oscar Schofield from Rutgers University's Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences. Join us now for Sounds of Science. Scott Glenn is a professor of physical oceanography. After earning his PhD at MIT, Scott worked for Shell Oil. Then, based at Harvard, he led Navy projects in ocean forecasting. He joined Rutgers in 1990 when the Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences was founded. Scott, welcome to NJN Public Radio and Sounds of Science.
Thanks, Patrick. Good to be here.
Oscar Schofield is a professor of biological oceanography. He did his doctoral research at the University of California in Santa Barbara and stayed on there to do research on the ozone hole. From there, he moved to Louisiana to do aquaculture research for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He and Scott have been close collaborators since his job interview at Rutgers, which he joined in 1995. Oscar, welcome.
Thanks for having us. We're excited to be here.
Okay, here we are on the blue planet, the water planet. Oceans are largely what makes the Earth the Earth. Oceans touch the lives of people who will never even see them through their influence on climate, ecology, and biological productivity. Yet it's often said, at least by people who'd like to see more investment in your line of research, that we know as much about outer space, clear to the edge of the visible universe, as we know about our oceans. Scott and Oscar, let's talk about what you and your colleagues are doing about that, beginning right here off the coast of New Jersey.
Yeah, thanks, Patrick. We've been on this exploration tour of New Jersey for about 15 years now. We began in the early 90s off of Tuckerton, and there we were working mostly on the time side of the problem. How can we stay offshore? How can we stay at sea for long periods of time? And we used some very traditional technologies that you'll see all the time, moorings, ships, and we started working with this thing called a cabled observatory offshore. And we really were able to do much better, being able to stay out during storms and see things people had never seen before. But working time was exciting and all, but we also had to start moving on beyond that. We had to start worrying about space, because you can't just stay in the same spot forever. And that was the next challenge. How do we start exploring through space?
Let's talk about what kinds of measurements you're making as well, before moving on to how you made that transition to the sort of the space dimensions of ocean research. So what kinds of measurements are important and why?
Well, there's a bunch of measurements you make. You need to know things about the physics of the ocean. That'll be things like temperature, salinity, where are the currents going, how fast are they going. We need to know about the biology. How much plant material is there? What's the oxygen concentration? If the oxygen gets too low, things die. That's not good. You need to know about how many fish are there. And all those technologies, oceanographers have been working for over a century to develop instruments to measure that. And like Scott was saying, all the design was, how do you measure that at a single place? A big buoy. And you hang them off there and you strap them up to a car battery and you let them run for as long as possible. That's how we used to do it.
And so one of the things that we really did make advances on was the interdisciplinary aspects. We brought physics physical scientists together with biological scientists, with chemical science, and that was important. And so we built that base of understanding and the ability to talk to each other. Previously, we'd be in our own disciplines and we'd never even see the other disciplines. But now we're working together and we're trying to go beyond that.
And helping you to do that are these maturing technologies of satellite observation, coastal radars, and yes, what you call gliders, which I'm going to ask you to describe.
Well, we started with our satellite dishes, and we started putting them on our own coastal stations so we could acquire data directly from the satellites. And not just our own U.S. satellites that we could get from the government, but also from other countries like China and India. And so that gave us access to more visits, from more looks from above, and our first shot at looking at it in space. And the satellites tell us what's in the water, and from there we went on to our coastal radars. And the radars are simple white posts that we put up on the beach. You'll see them all along the coast of New Jersey, and they act like the police radars that tell you the speed of your car. Now we're measuring the speed of the water. And so the satellites tell us what's in the water, and then where, and the radars tell us which way the water's flowing. But all that's at the surface. We have to have some way of getting below the surface, and that's where the vehicles come in.
Yeah. The first revolution of oceanography were those satellite maps. And right now we're at the dawn of a new revolution in oceanography, which is subsurface maps, and that's where these robotic systems come in. So a glide, there's two types of robot you put in the ocean. One has a propeller, can control its position, but it can't be out there very long, maybe a day, you know, and you can't cover much space in a day. Gliders don't have a propeller. They change their buoyancy by sucking a little water inside of them, makes them just heavy enough to sink. They sink forward. They have wings and a rudder. And then when they get to the depth they're supposed to, they push the water out, become light, and float up. But now they don't have a propeller, so a single set of batteries can last you a month, 2 months, 3 months. The sky's the limit. And so we can be at sea making spatial maps all around the world every day of the year.
I'd like to go back over the development of that program, particularly in your institute. In the beginning, as I believe you've told me before, the first time you let loose one of those gliders off the Jersey coast, you had a rope tied to it. And now you have had them running all over the world. And I gather you've got a very ambitious project just starting up. So I'm going to ask you to go over the way that's developed.
Yeah, we started with Doug Webb. We met him at a conference at MIT, and we were all talking there about our coastal predictive skill experiments that we were doing off Tuckerton. And we saw Doug Webb give this amazing talk about these vehicles that ran without a propeller, just on buoyancy. And for those few seconds, we thought we glimpsed the future. And we said, we just grabbed that. And we invited him down, and he brought a glider, one of the very first ones. They'd never even been in the ocean. And he asked us if we wanted to go to sea with it. And we says, you know, Doug, don't take us. Take our students. Take a student with you. And they ended up taking Josh Kohut, who's now a professor there at Rutgers. And he took him to sea, and he had Josh tie a rope to the glider, and they put it in. And all he had to do was go down to the bottom of the ocean and come back all by itself. And we called it a successful year. That was back in 1999. And so in the decade that's followed, we've had just years of development with Doug.
Yeah. And in the beginning, it starts off as sort of a collaboration with the scientists and the engineers working together. But now it's transitioned to where scientists can just use it as a tool. So we started as a science group flying gliders as a science tool in about October 2003. And since then, now we've covered over 40,000 kilometers underwater. We've essentially done the full circumference of Earth as scientists flying these robotic systems and all over the world, from Antarctica through European waters, all along the coastal United States.
So the next phase of that, you know, first Doug was flying it, then the scientists were flying it. How do we get the students to fly it? And that was the next step. And that's something we just completed just yesterday, where we built our first vehicle that we think can really fly for long distances, possibly across all the way across the ocean, and we're going to give that to the undergraduates. We have undergraduates classes that are now flying these things. They just completed a flight from New Jersey all the way to Halifax. We're going to see what they can do with this thing over the summer and let them fly this vehicle.
And for people who haven't visited that website where you really can see real-time data from your various instruments and get an idea of what you mean when you say your students are, you know, in control and flying these gliders, could you describe where all this data comes together and sort of the command central from which the students are controlling these flights?
Yeah, our main control center is in New Brunswick on Rutgers' main campus. SEBS, the School of Environment and Biological Sciences. And it's essentially a room where all the data is deposited in real time. And it has a series of consoles where all the data is displayed. You can see all the data from the satellites, the radars, and the gliders and make decisions of what you should do next. And it's a room that's constantly filled with scientists, students, visitors from all around the world who essentially go to see in this room all year round. And that's a revolution. When I was trained as a oceanographer, I would go to sea for 2-3 months at a time and maybe come back with 12 data points. Now I can go to sea for a half hour and walk out in a half hour with 1,000 data points. And the students can take direct control over the computers and redirect where these robots should fly. And part of it is training them, how do they read the data? How do they make a smart decision of where the robot should go? What's, you know, and also the risks involved, because that's an adventure.
And so what we want to do is bring that adventure to campus. Instead of having to go to sea and be on a ship isolated from your students, your family, how do you do that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all year round? And so by bringing this laboratory, this cool room, this for the Coastal Ocean Observation Lab, our control center there, we can place ourselves at sea anywhere in the world.
And we do it for free in terms of people accessing the data. The old way you used to go to sea is a scientist would go out, collect their 10 data points, hoard it, protect it, share it with no one, and then in 5 years you might get access to it. Here it's plotted by computers, it's posted to the World Wide Web, and the general public log in all the time. We get close to 250,000 web hits per day during the summer, and about 70% of it is from the general public who want to know where should they go swimming, where should they go fishing, what's the weather like at the shore.
That is quite a contrast to the first 100-130 years or so of oceanography. So you're listening to Sounds of Science from NJN Public Radio. I'm Patrick Regan. Scott Glenn and Oscar Schofield are here with me to talk about establishing ocean observatories locally and around the world. So I wanted to ask you what other institutions are doing, say Stevens, Woods Hole, Scripps, Lamont, Monterey Bay, to move toward this same goal of year-round data collection over wide geographic areas.
Yeah, so locally here in New Jersey, we've gotten together with the other New Jersey institutions that are building ocean observatories. And the main ones there are Stevens Institute of Technology and Monmouth University. And so we've developed there the New Jersey Integrated Ocean Observing System to mimic what's going on nationally, where the groups are coming together from different universities and realizing that by working together, we can complement each other and cover more ground and do more than any of us can do individually. And this is supported all the way to the top levels of the presidents of each university.
If we go regionally, all the states are realizing that the oceans are a major part of their economy. The economy associated with the ocean off New Jersey is larger than the agricultural economy in New Jersey, and we don't manage it at all. And so a lot of states, based on the successes of these observatories, now see it as a cost-effective management tool. So what you're seeing at Woods Hole, you're seeing at University of Connecticut, you're seeing at University of Maine, every state that's on the coast is developing an observatory. The federal government realizes you need to tie all these observatories together. The states have boundaries. The ocean has no boundaries or borders. And so the federal government is trying to develop the system to integrate everything. And Scott's humble. He said he was, you know, just sort of working with other people. The New Jersey groups led by Scott and Stevens and Monmouth are the leaders in it. And so I'll say what he won't.
All right. So how do you see these more or less local or regional ocean observatories that are taking shape today coming together into a global science network?
Yeah, we'll first make the jump to the national level, where we have our region and we're building these, like the radar systems, how we're putting them together first in New Jersey and then linking them to the other systems in the other states. And those radars are giving us information on ocean currents. And one of the things that happens when ocean currents, with one of the uses of the ocean currents, is to help for search and rescue. When people get lost at sea, the Coast Guard is very good at rescuing you if they know where to find you. Typically, they rescue about 10 people a day. Unfortunately, there might be more going in the water. And the ones that are lost are usually lost just because we don't know where to look. They're usually looking for you in a place the size of New Jersey, which is pretty big. And so by having an idea of where the currents are, you can better predict where people are going to be if they run into trouble and save more lives. They estimate they'll save about 50 lives a year if we can implement this system nationwide. So we're building these things out nationwide, just like we have here in New Jersey, to help with people like that, save that. And then those things will then go across the world. Other places like Spain we're working with, I'm building these same networks over there. And use by use, we'll just keep expanding around the world, step by step.
Yeah. What is the status of, you know, of this expansion in other parts of the world?
Some are more mature. Some countries in Europe have been installing systems just like the U.S. over the last decade. The Mediterranean has a beautiful system that they've been building up over a decade. But what we're starting to see now that's really exciting is developing nations who need to manage their fisheries and all these realize they can't afford to have a fleet of ships out there. But these new technologies are like leapfrog technologies, like the cell phone was to these developing countries, where now they'll be able to manage their waters, manage their fisheries, manage their pollution on a much smaller budget. Because the most expensive part about going into the ocean is to pay the human to be out on the ocean. And so if these technologies allow us to bypass that, everyone has access. And then with the cyber world, every data bit can be combined from everywhere in the world and go into these big databases. And so this cyber infrastructure ties us together as one big ocean family.
And to what extent are those developments maybe getting ahead of or paving the way for some kind of global leadership or governance that can help tie all these efforts together?
Yes, we're already going to sea all over the world, something we couldn't do before, all over the world at the same time. And that's unique. We used to have, if you went out to sea on a ship, you were on that ship and that was the only place you saw. Right now, because we're all connected by the World Wide Web and because all this data can come into these rooms around the world, we can be at sea at various places around the world hour by hour. And be doing experiments in all these locations at the same time, bringing students along with us the whole time, and even doing it from our homes.
That is one of the most exciting things about it, the students. As excited as some people get by the prospect of going to sea, the prospect of actually being able to do real research from your college campus mm-hmm. is very exciting and must be inspiring.
It's We were in Lithuania 2 years ago, and a pretty high-up person in NOAA sat us down, and he said, you have to do this for the good of your country. You have to inspire the next generation of engineers and scientists, and you have to develop the technologies to keep us in the ocean. And so that's pretty shocking to get a comment like that over a beer. But it is really important, and we think that this is an opportunity to excite kids to go into the sciences and engineering, which we need for our national security, for environmental security, for economic security. And the U.S. needs to train more scientists and engineers, and we think this will be a cutting-edge tool for that.
All right. You're listening to Sounds of Science on NJN Public Radio. I'm Patrick Regan, and my guests are Scott Glenn and Oscar Schofield of Rutgers University. We've been talking about launching ocean observatories, linking technologies from satellites to underwater robots to discover more about our home planet. So, in closing, at least for today, I want to invite you to think about two things. One, what are some of the biggest open questions in science that might be addressed by the kinds of data that ocean observatories might yield? And second, I'm going to invite you to imagine what more could be done if the United States or an international consortium could mount the equivalent of a space program for Earth's oceans.
So I'll tackle the first part of the question. We know the oceans are changing. We know that will change Earth as we know it. Half the oxygen on Earth comes from the plants in the ocean. With climate change and with human interactions, we know the oceans are going to go to a different place. It's pretty important to figure out where we're going to end up. And so that is one of the big drivers that observatories will help.
We're always taught in school that there's one ocean out there that connects us all. And by having these observatories in place, we connect to young people around the world and bring all of this to their houses. We'll be exploring the ocean with fleets of robots, things that we've never had before. And that's that future where autonomous systems are flying beneath the sea, feeding back data and linking our oceans to the people.
It's an exciting prospect with a lot of scientific and maybe practical benefits that it could deliver. I want to thank you, Oscar Schofield and Scott Glenn, for joining me and our audience for Sounds of Science on NJN Public Radio. Thanks again.
Thank you.